Accession number 28898, Reel 3.
That's Charles at Reel 3. What was the next stage after?
Well, in fact, on this AFTS, Advanced Flying Training, they had a couple of hurricanes. And those that were going to be fighter pilots were allowed to fly one. Now, this was something that my heart skipped several beats when they said, because I wondered what these hurricanes were there for. So you're going to fly a hurricane today? I said, you must be joking, because they weren't dual-seat hurricanes. No, you're going to fly one. It's quite simple. Just fly it like you flew the Miles Master. And it's much more responsive, a bit quicker. Lands nice and easily. Hurricane did land beautifully. A very simple aircraft land. But I thought, all right. So, flew a Hurricane. And that was really a heartbeat a bit, because you're all on your own. You can't, no one's in there with you. And you just have to go. And but it was a lovely Hurricane was a lovely aeroplane to fly. Once airborne, it was responsive, nice and light on the controls. It was really a nice gentleman's aircraft, Hurricane. And landing it that just came in and just three-pointed all without doing anything about it. I mean, the Spitfire used to go like a Tiger Moth Spitfire. But the Hurricane just came down beautifully. But I tell you, my heart was in my mouth when I said, you just had to go. Not many of us did that. I think just the people who were going on the fighters. Well, we all were on Masters going on the fighters, I suppose. But some were going to fail, so perhaps they didn't do it. I don't know. I can't remember everybody flying a Hurricane.
Did somebody just show you around the cockpit?
Well, you have pilot's notes. Every aircraft has its pilot's notes. And you take those back to your room and you read them thoroughly. It's like handbook for a car. Tells you whatever controls for and what not to do and what to do and anything. And you're shown around very carefully by an instructor, saying that's how they take off with a bit more power, and that's the stick, and pump the primer pump to get it started. And you've told quite a lot about it before you go, and how it flies, and what speed to start to get it off the ground, and what speed to come in at, and all everything you want to know apart from flying it, really. But fortunately, I mean, of all the fighting fighter aircraft ever built, I think the Hurricane was probably the easiest to fly. It was a very simple airplane to fly. Responsive, rugged, had no bad habits. It was an easy aircraft to land. It flew straight and level nice and easily. It was just a very nice airplane.
What was visibility like from the cockpit?
Not good, because you had it had a hood which came forward and metal straps going around it. And so, of all the fighter aircraft that I flew, the Hurricane had the poorest visibility. It's a rather smallish hood with the metal straps going around the top to hold them. I don't know why. The Spitfire didn't need them. But anyway, that's the way it was built.
And what about the cockpit layout? What happened?
Well, that's more complicated. More things to do. Retracting undercar, for example. Well, I had that in the Master, what am I talking about? Retracting undercar in the Master. Starting was a bit more tricky. Starting the engine, you had a priming pump. You had to unscrew this great brass knob and pump it several times, which pumped petrol into the cylinders before they started from the battery outside. Right, then it wouldn't start. It wouldn't stop. So if you got over primed, you get sheets of flame coming back from the exhaust, which were not dangerous but frightening, and it still wouldn't start. So you kept it rotating until that flame was gone, and it started again. So you had to get the priming just right, and the throttle setting just right. Yes, there's more instrumentation, but I can't think what it was now. I mean, when we first got into the cockpit, I thought, I don't remember what that's for. But it was comfortable. Although, as I say, because visibility was limited, you felt more sort of tied into the aircraft. But as I say, it was very, very. When I took it off, I was most surprised. I thought, well, it's easier than a master. Faster, but it was easy. And landing was really, took me by surprise. It just floated in and just settled down, freewheeled.
Is that quite a strange feeling? Because were you almost expecting a hurricane to be more complex than that?
Oh, yes. I thought, oh, God, it's going to be terrible to fly this thing. Oh. But it wasn't. It was, once I was airborne, it was absolutely delightful. And at landing, I thought, landing's going to be very tricky. But it wasn't. I came in and hit the right spot, and it just stayed down.
And what about the controls? Did they handle... Are they more sensitive than the master was?
About the same. The master's a bit heavy, I think, if I remember rightly. Hurricanes were about the same. Yeah, I had a sort of round grip handle, the button knob there, with a gun button there, a round handle on top. But, no, reasonably light. No, what that was. It was about the same as a master, really. Not like a tiger moth with the slightest twitch. It was moving about like all over the place. Very, very gentlemanly aircraft to fly a Hurricane.
How did you control the retractable undercarriage? What do you use there?
I'm trying to think. A Hurricane had a little gear sort of thing. Yes, take it out of the pocket, do that, and then the car came up. And the opposite way to put it down, of course. But there again, you could only put it down at a certain speed, fairly low speed, or you'd rip it off or damage it somehow. And it had flaps like a Miles Master. It was just a sort of more advanced Miles Master, really, but landed easier.
And you say it was just a few of you who practiced on the Hurricanes?
As far as I can remember, yes, not everybody did. I don't know why that was. I don't know really why. One of the reasons was because I was ahead in my exercises, further ahead than some of the pilots were. I'd done them all several over and over, so they still had time to go on the course. So they said, okay, put them into a Hurricane, let him have a go on that. Because the next step was going up to Grangemouth, 58 OTU, where he was straight on the Spitfires. And that was a different experience.
So what happened there? Can you take me through the process of arriving and
well, as I said, well, I kept wondering, am I going to make a fighter pilot? Well, they say, well, you perhaps better divert you onto transports or something. And so when I heard I was going to 58 OTU, Operational Training Unit at Grangemouth, I knew that was a Spitfire OTU, and I thought, got it. So, went up there and still doing ground course, still doing academic studies as well about theory of flight and how Spitfires were built and where the weak and strong points were in the fuselage. Just generally letting you know everything you possibly could about what you're going to do. And the Spit 1, which was the aircraft I first flew, was a very basic Spitfire. It had no automatic undercarriage. You had a front of the undercarriage. So, and because it was very light on the elevators, you can see feathers going up who've never flown one before, or first flights, because you're concentrating. And you're doing this with a stick, of course. And so they're flying away like that with the undercarriage slowly coming up. Or went up side up outwards, but you can see them sort of
very like a gently undulating
wave. Along, yeah. But they were there. The first Spitfires actually had fabric ailerons, and they got very heavy in a dive. Very heavy. They had a really beef them. The latest Spitfires have metal ailerons, but it's just a dramatic difference. Very quick on the controls then. But you could see out of a Spitfire nicely because it had a decent hood, no straps or anything on it. It was a very nice aeroplane to fly again. But the first impressions were a bit more worrying, mainly because landing was difficult. Landing was just like a tiger moth. It floated. Unless you got it exactly right, it's difficult to three-point it. It's very sensitive for the elevators. But a very reliable engine. And just a very pleasant aircraft to fly, except if you're doing a high-speed job. The ailerons got very heavy, the fabric-covered ailerons were very heavy, made the aircraft very heavy laterally, very heavy. Very light, four and a half, very light, and very heavy laterally. But later, for Spitfires, they changed that and put metal ailerons on, and that's what made all the difference in the world. Just became very light all around them.
I've heard it described as being quite a cramped cockpit.
Oh yes, it was cramped. It was quite cramped. The Americans used to build their aircraft around the pilot's comfort. They would have sort of armchairs and things. As I said, we were just saying about the American Thunderbolt fighter, that their evasive action as they were being fired at was to take the straps off and run around the cockpit. Because it's so big, you know, massive room. Put your feet out, like, smoke a cigar, and lash tray. But a Spitfire was a, you could just get into it. And when you see the hood too, you really felt that you were part of the aircraft. And that was the beauty of flying a Spitfire, was that you felt you were flying yourself. Wherever you wanted to go, you just sort of automatically pointed in that direction and it went there. And it was a lovely aircraft. The later marks particularly were great. Spitfire, the Spit 2 was probably the nicest airplane I ever flew. Slightly more powerful engine. And propeller was different, I think. I can't remember now. It was just an ideal airplane, a nice aerobatic aircraft.
Did it have any vices in flight at all that you had to?
No, not really. No, I didn't have any vices. It was a viceless aircraft. It really was viceless. You could really ill treat it. It wouldn't do anything nasty.
Did you get a sensation of speed with it at low levels as well?
Oh yeah, because you did. I mean, we didn't. Well, if we're going out on an operation, which is later on, of course, we FOTU went squadron, a low level. You got a feeling of speed. Quite definitely. I suppose we did about, 280 knots or something like that. About 300 miles an hour, but I mean, compared to the later jets, it was quite slow. but it was a very, the Spitfire really was a fighter pilot's dream.
What was your pattern of training at the OTU? What were the types of things you were doing there?
We did formation flying there. The first time we did formation flying, as far as I can remember. I don't think we did any FTS. I'm sure we didn't. But we did at OTU. And that's the question of creeping up on the other aircraft very gently and getting closer and closer, and he's flying up until you're sort of 20 yards away, then 10 yards away, then 5 yards away, and you're always doing this. The red arrows, for example, look as though they're all welded together, don't they? If you're in one, if you're doing that, they're like this, bobbing up and down. I used to like formation flying. It's just very delicately sort of getting the aircraft right in there, just tucking it in so your wingtip was pointing against his round and about 2 feet behind his wing. But not absolutely. If you're not careful, you get slipstream from his wing, which would jolt your wing up and down. But it was responsive to the armor controls, responsive to the engine. See, flying formation in a propeller-driven aircraft is far easier than a jet aircraft, because a Spitfire, for example, when you throttle back, the air screw went into a coarser pitch and acted as a brake, and it had a braking effect. Open the throttle, immediate acceleration, so you could go back and forth quickly. Jet, there's lag. If you open the throttle, as a jet before it actually starts. And when you close the throttle, you still keep going for a while before it comes back again. So a flying formation in a jet is a different proposition altogether from a Spitfire. But, no, the Spitfire is just a beautiful airplane.
Could you describe pitch, what it means?
A pitch? Well, the propeller could be either flat-bladed in front of you, or it could be at an angle. It could turn at an angle through the hub of the propeller cone. And the faster you went, the coarser was the pitch. It's like changing gear in a car. And for takeoff, the pitch was very flat, so it was biting the air in smaller chunks. And as you got more and more, faster and faster, it coarsened out. It's because you're going faster, you needed less bites of the air. And that was one of the good things. When they eventually, with the Spitfire, they combined the propeller with the pitch control. So that when you open the throttle fast, it automatically wound the pitch back, so you accelerated. When you pulled, and likewise, when you, as you picked up speed, it used to coarsen. Then if you slammed it too, it would fine blade the pitch, so it acts as a brake. So you have great control over the forward and aft speed. Very good for formation flying. And also, you had one less lever to contend with. As a pitch lever. I was out of take out. So, that's what pitch is all about. It's just the angle of the blade of the propeller against the airstream. Fine pitch is when it's very flat against the airstream. Coarse pitch is when it's taking great chunks of air out. Goes coarse.
And what about the engine? What about the Spitfire's engine? What was that?
Well, it started off with a Merlin 1, which was not very powerful. It had about 1,200 horsepower. And on Spit 9, which was the latest aircraft I flew, which was a really powerful airplane, it was up to about 3,500. And it had two turbochargers. I mean, you're climbing up, for example, to get up to about 18,000, 19,000 feet. And then you'd throttle back and switch the top turbocharger, which surged from the engine, like taking off from the ground. Because as you get high, you tend to lose power, getting less air going through and less petrol, you tend to lose power. But most dogfights used to take place up at about 30,000 feet or start up there. So the more power you could get at altitude, the better chance you had in a dogfight. So that's when I don't know whether the Germans had the same thing, but that was delightful to have the pitch control attached to the throttle.
Were they reliable engines?
Very, very. I never had a Spitfire engine actually stop on me. I had had some real bit wonky where I had a sort of forced land, but very reliable. I mean, when you think of the treatment they had, brand new engine, put in the aircraft, you take it up in the dogfight, and you're slamming the throttle wide open, you're getting 14 pounds of thrust, whatever it is, and you're slamming it back fully closed again, then slamming it wide open again, constantly. I mean, we had a strain on the engine. Just took it all. They were made by women. And there, in fact, there's a piston of the Spitfire. And they're down there. But they're very, very reliable engine, Merlin engines. In fact, the Americans put me into a lot of their aircraft. Americans put me into their Mustangs.
When you were at OTU, was that the stage where you became involved in gunnery practice?
No, we didn't do any at OTU. Or did we? I can't remember. I just cannot remember. I must have done it somewhere, because my next posting was to 118 Squadron down at Ibsley, 910 Group, on the south coast. I just cannot remember.
Was there still this pressure to get the pilots through the system? Were you aware of that at this stage? Because you said there had been a huge pressure at the start to get the whole thing moving, get pilots trained. Was that still...
Oh yes, because straight from here, you see, I was straight down to an operational squadron on the south coast, 10 Group, Ibsley, a place called Ibsley, just north of Southampton. And well, I was in action within a few days of being down there.
So when was this? What period?
Now, this was in early 41. 118 Squadron, Ibsley. And we had Spitfires. They're nice aircraft. We had two 20mm cannons and four 50 calibre Brownings, which were a lot of firepower. When you hit something, it stayed hit. But you see, you only carried about, 5 or 6 seconds of ammunition. You couldn't sort of keep blazing away. You had to go in little blips. Mind you, that's fired off about 1,000 rounds each blip. But yes, you had a lot of firepower. And sorry, what question did you ask me?
It was when you doing gunnery practice, but obviously did
I can't remember. But I do remember doing gunnery practice down at 118 with an aircraft towing a drogue behind it, and you come in and fire at that, and then they land the drogue, see how many shot, how many holes there are in it. And to begin with, you think you've got a bit full, and there are none on it, not a single mark on it. This is all about deflection shooting, because pilot towing this drogue, you see, he didn't want you to come into only 5 degrees, because 2 or 3 more degrees would be hitting him. So you had to break off at about 10 degrees, and it was hard to hit the drogue at 10 degrees. But we used to get quite good at it. And it was a good way of teaching you, because you could get deflection on it and so on.
Can you explain deflection?
Well, deflection, you see, if you fire directly at an aircraft at right angles, the chance of hitting it is zero, because it's flashing through your stream of bullets. So the closer you can get in behind it, the more you've got a stationary target. The more the angle widens between your firing at it and the aircraft you're firing at, the further you've got to fire ahead of him, so he runs into your bullets, as it were. And the guns on a Spitfire will harmonise to all come to a cone at 250 yards. To 250 yards, you're getting a really good bunch of fire. So the whole idea was to get as close into 250 yards as you could, and as far as near behind. Because if you're out at 40 degrees, people like Paddy Finucane and Scribble Burning, they could shoot an aircraft down at 30 degrees. And on their gun sight, you had a ring and a cross going through it, a dot in the middle. Now, you're looking through that, on the screen, looking through that. No, it's not a screen, it's just a little screen in front of you, the earlier ones, with jet ones, it was on there. Anyway, equations for all this. I mean, they worked on the ground that if you're doing 400 miles an hour and you're at 30 degrees, you had to have so many rings ahead of him. So you knew exactly what you should be doing, but you're not watching the speed when you're in a dogfight. You're not watching anything except the aircraft you're trying to hit. And the idea, so you know your angle off, so you might have your ring right out here, and he's here, but then it's got to be in line with him. So the chance of hitting are minimal. Bullets are dropping off of it. I once sat behind a Focke Wulf 190. I got right up close behind him because he hadn't seen me. And I was literally far as I was, shed away from him. Fired all my ammunition at him. Didn't hit him. He just stood there. I thought, what the hell's happening? Of course, what was happening? My gun sight's up here, and the guns are down there from the wings. So my gun sight on his tail, all my shells were going underneath him. So you had to, if you hit another aircraft in a dogfight, you're doing pretty well. Even if you had everything you thought was absolutely smack on, you could fire all your ammunition and you wouldn't see a thing on it, see a mark on it. So it was a lot of luck in hitting another aircraft in a dogfight.
You mentioned your Spitfires had a cannon. How did the cannon operate?
We had a Hispana Suiza, French design, 20mm cannon. It just operated just like a machine gun. It had a belt of these cannon shells, in a box in the wing, and they just ran through the mechanism. It started off at about 650 rounds a minute and worked up to about 1200, because it gets faster than what it goes, warms up. So it was pretty good, you know, threw out a lot of shells.
What kind of damage would a cannon shell cause to another aircraft?
Well, it depends. You see, we had four or five different types of cannon shells. We had incendiary, which was just to set things alight, to burst in flame. Armour-piercing, which were very pointed and heavy shells. What do we call them? Shells that you can see in the game.
Tracer
shell. And one of high explosive hell. I can't remember what it was now. The four different types of shells. You made a fairly big hole in something if you hit it, because you'd hit at least with four shells. So you'd burst into flames, or a great big hole would appear inside of it. Or you just snick your wing and a bit of fly off the wing, you know. And if you're 30,000 feet, you never knew what happened to that aircraft. You just hit it. Very difficult. They suddenly clamped down on claiming. After the Battle of Britain, when the Air Ministry suddenly realised that pilots had overclaimed by far how many aircraft had shot down, said, hey, we can't have this, or we won't know what's going on. We've got to be more careful about how we claim. And so we had three categories: definitely destroyed, probably destroyed, and damaged. Now, when you're dogfighting up at about between 25 and 30 feet, or above 30,000 feet, you fire an aircraft and hit it. Unless you watch it go right down to the ground, which you're not inclined to do when you're being shot at yourself, you don't know whether it's going to pull out and fly away with this limb of the aircraft and land or not. So we couldn't claim that as a destroyed. If it was badly damaged, and perhaps the engine stopped and the wheel off, it was probably destroyed, we're fairly certain in our eyes. And if it was just a bit blown out of it, that was damaged. But they really clamped on that. In fact, Paddy Finucane, he was such a crack shot. Early one morning, we were flying as a squadron. It was a practice flight up the channel, but actually he went into France. And as he went in, their radar obviously picked us up, and they scrambled some 190s. And we saw below us, finger four, we called them finger four. They were flying a finger four, you know, leader there, number two there, number three there, number four there. 250 yards separating from each other, so you could see behind each other. The idea of that was flat, so you could see behind the tail of the other aircraft. And these two groups of one line is flying up into finger fours underneath us, presumably climbing up to intercept us, but the radar's got us a bit further back with them. And he said, right, and his eye, he has fantastic eyesight. He said, bandits below us, come on, we're going down. So he went down, I was his number two, and they saw us coming. And they started to flip over and half roll to get out of the way. And the last one to do it, at a tremendous range, it must have been 800 yards or 600-700 yards, as it was half over, Paddy fired at it, and it just blew it up. Just hit it and blew it up. Incredible. The others got out of the way, and we never saw them again. We never saw any more enemy aircraft. When we got back, he said to us, and he was the one who had been, I think it was Bader or one of the leaders, didn't like him at all, didn't like Paddy Finucane. Said he was a bullshit little Irishman who overclaimed everything. So when he got back, he said to us, look, fellas, you didn't see me hit the aircraft. I said, I'm not going to claim it. So when he shot it down, who's going to believe me? Forget it. It got to that point where people were terrified of claiming for aircraft that they'd got, which they'd be questioned about. But he was a fantastic shot. His eyesight too, and he could hit an aircraft at any angle. It was instinctive. He didn't worry about rings, he just knew. He was very good clay pigeon shooter, there were. Berling was. I mean, he could hit clay at right angles, boom, she could pull it, you know, exactly instinctively how far to pull ahead. When I went to Redmore, where Scribble Billing was a, this is when I came off MSFU, went to Redmore to do a refresher on Spitfires before going back to the Spitfire Squadron. He was an instructor there, and he was the gunnery instructor. And he would take us up in a master. Now, a master had one gun in the wing, way out in the wing. So when you fired it, the wing aircraft slewed like this. He had a, in the back seat, with his draft heel hood up, little sword I told you about, through a ring and bead sight, he could put every shot into a drogue. It was quite incredible.